Thank you for listening to this podcast from KX93.5, Laguna's only FM. We invite you to listen to more music and talk on our grassroots nonprofit radio station in Laguna Beach, California, from anywhere in the world on KX93.5.com/listen or on our smartphone apps. But right now, here's that podcast from KX93.5.
KXRN LP Laguna Niguel, Laguna Beach. Member supported KX93.5. This disclaimer is a statement notifying the listening audience that any opinion expressed on the air is not reflective of KX93.5, its management, or its board of directors.
And good morning, Laguna Beach, and welcome to Moody with Dr. Sage. I'm your host, Kim Sage, and I'm here today to talk to you about self-compassion and self-love and why they're so important. But before I do that, let me just do a quick few station pieces of business, which is just want to remind everyone to check out KX93.5, our website, and see if you want to, attend the Nancy Wilson of Heart concert, which is our huge fundraiser. It's going to be held at the Pageant of the Masters on December 8th. And if you also are a Heart super fan, there's a great opportunity we're giving away where you can submit to the station in writing why you are a Heart's big super fan. And someone will be chosen, and they're going to be giving away a pair of front row tickets to see Nancy Wilson of Heart perform with Roadcase Royale at our Christmas holiday party, I should say, on December 8th. And check that out. The winner will be announced on November 19th. Okay, so back to this idea today of Moody with Dr. Sage, where we explore our moods, our minds, and our real lives every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. And you can also listen via podcast at your convenience. So I thought it would be a good time to talk about self-compassion. I really, I think about every week what I want to talk about based on what's coming up either in the culture or for me at work. And I think because right now as a culture, and in the U.S. especially, we're really talking a lot about lack of compassion, how to see other people, how to think about someone besides yourself. And I think that it often comes up from the fact that if we don't feel good about ourselves, it's really difficult to have compassion for others. So I'm going to share with you, like I always do oftentimes, I kind of see the show as a workshop. I used to run a lot of group therapy modalities, as we would say, and I would pick topics and we'd go over them and talk about them. And that's kind of how I think about this show, but especially if there's not a guest, because I don't really see myself as just an interviewer. I really just see this as a way to share resources, topics that I'm often exposed to that I realize people are often not exposed to. So I'm going to share this woman. She has a PhD. Her name is Kristen Neff, N-E-F-F. She's an educational psychologist, and she's written a book, or a couple of books, actually. But the big one is called Self-Compassion, The Proven Power of Being Kind to Yourself. And I'm going to play a little 15-ish minute talk from her and then talk about self-compassion and self-love and give you this awesome exercise and some great ideas on how you can learn to be more compassionate with yourself. Because I think once you hear about why it's different from self-esteem and why it matters, I'm hoping that will inspire you. And also some ideas about what does it mean to love yourself? We hear this all the time. Oh, you just need to love yourself more. But that's a really hard thing to do. I mean, how do you actually do that? So I'm going to give you some ideas about that too. So this is a talk about the relationship between self-esteem and compassion. And here you go.
I guess you could say that I am a self-compassion evangelist. I love spreading the good word about self-compassion. I've devoted the last 10 years of my research career to studying the mental health benefits of self-compassion, and more recently I've been working on developing interventions to help people learn to be more compassionate to themselves in their lives. And the reason I'm so passionate about self-compassion is because I've really seen its power in my own life. I first learned about self-compassion in 1997 when I was finishing up my PhD at UC Berkeley. And I was going through a really hard time. I had just gotten out of a very messy divorce, was feeling a lot of shame and self-judgment. I was feeling a lot of stress. Would I finish my PhD? And then if I did, would I get a job? So I thought it would be a good time to learn how to practice meditation. So I signed up with a local Buddhist meditation group. And the very first evening, the very first course, the woman leading the group talked about the importance of compassion, not only for others, but also for ourselves. The importance of including ourselves in the circle of compassion, of treating ourselves with the same kindness, care, and concern that we treat a good friend. And it was like a light bulb went off over my head at that moment. I realized, well, first I thought, what? You know, you're allowed to be nice to yourself, and this is being encouraged. But I realized it was exactly what I needed in that difficult moment in my life. So really, from that day forward, I can say I intentionally tried to be more compassionate to myself, and it made a huge difference almost immediately. And then, luckily, I did get a job. I did 2 years of postdoctoral study with one of the country's leading self-esteem researchers. And while working with her, I started to realize that self-compassion offered a lot of benefits that self-esteem didn't. All right, so let me start by defining what I mean by self-esteem. Self-esteem is a global evaluation of self-worth, a judgment: am I a good person or am I a bad person? And for many years, psychologists really saw self-esteem as the ultimate marker of psychological health. And there's a reason for that. There's lots of research that shows if you have low self-esteem, if you hate yourself, you're going to be depressed, you're going to be anxious, you're going to have all sorts of psychological problems. If it gets really bad, you might even consider suicide. However, high self-esteem also can be problematic. The problem is not if you have it, it's how you get it. Right? So in American culture, to have high self-esteem, we have to feel special and above average. Okay? If I told any one of you your work performance, oh, it's average, or you're an average mother, or if you told me afterwards that this talk was average, I'd be crushed, right? It's not okay to be average. It's considered an insult to be average. So what's the problem with that if all of us have to be above average at the same time? Right? Are the words logical impossibilities springing to mind here? Right? Okay. So what happens if we all have to feel above average is we start playing these little games. We start subtly finding ways to puff ourselves up and to put others down so we can feel better about ourselves in comparison. And some people actually take this to an extreme. You may or may not know, but there is an epidemic of narcissism in this culture. They've been tracking the narcissism levels of college undergraduates for the past 25 years, and they are at the highest levels ever recorded. And actually, a lot of psychologists believe this is because of the self-esteem movement in the schools. Okay? And there are a lot of nasty social dynamics that can stem from needing to feel better than others to feel good about ourselves. We also have an epidemic of bullying in our culture, in our schools. Well, why do kids bully? Why do kids who are forming their sense of self feel they've got to bully others? It's partly to build their own sense of self-esteem, to feel that they are stronger, more powerful than these other kids that they're picking on. Or why are people prejudiced? Why do we feel that our religious group or our ethnic group or our political party is better than the other group? Partly in order to enhance our own self-esteem. Another problem with self-esteem is that it's contingent. It's contingent on success. We only feel good about ourselves when we succeed in those domains of life that are important to us. But what happens when we fail? What happens when we don't meet our ideal standards? We feel lousy. We feel terrible about ourselves. And for women, this is especially hard because what do you think research shows? Around the world, the number one domain in which women invest their self-esteem. right? Our perception of how attractive we are. And the standards for women are so high. How can we feel above average in looks when we're looking at all these supermodels? Even the supermodels feel insecure compared to other supermodels, right? It's very interesting. If you look at this developmentally, around third grade, boys and girls both think they're pretty attractive, and they have fairly high levels of self-esteem. And then for boys, about the end of sixth grade, yeah, looking pretty good, feeling pretty good. End of high school, looking good, feeling good about myself. But for girls, after third grade, their perception of how attractive they are, and therefore their self-esteem, starts to take a nosedive. Okay? Starts very young. So how do we get off this treadmill, this constant need to feel better than others so that we can feel good about ourselves? Well, that's where self-compassion comes in, okay? Self-compassion is not a way of judging ourselves positively. Self-compassion is a way of relating to ourselves kindly, embracing ourselves as we are, flaws and all. I actually define self-compassion in my research as having three core components. The first, you might say, is the most obvious, and that is treating ourselves with kindness versus harsh self-judgment. Treating ourselves like we treat a good friend, with encouragement, understanding, empathy, patience, gentleness. But if you stop to check in with how we treat ourselves, especially on a bad day when things aren't going so well, we are often harsher and more cruel to ourselves in the language we use. We say things to ourselves we would never say to someone we cared about. We say things to ourselves that we probably even wouldn't say to someone we didn't like very much. Okay, we are often our own worst enemy. So with self-compassion, we reverse that pattern and start treating ourselves like we treat our good friends. The second component of self-compassion is common humanity. All right, where self-esteem asks, how am I different than others? Self-compassion says, well, how am I the same as others? And one of the ways we are the same as others, what does it mean to be human? To be human means to be imperfect. All of us, everyone in the entire globe, we are imperfect as people and our lives are imperfect. That is the shared human experience. Often what happens, though, irrationally, when we notice something about ourselves, we haven't reached our goal, or we're struggling in life, we feel as if something has gone wrong here. This is abnormal. This shouldn't be this way. I shouldn't be, you know, failing to reach my goals. And it's that feeling of abnormality, of separation from others, that is so psychologically damaging. We make it so much worse by feeling we're isolated in our suffering and our imperfection, when in fact that's precisely what connects us to other people. And then the third component of self-compassion is mindfulness. Mindfulness means being with what is in the present moment. And we need to be able to turn toward, acknowledge, validate, and accept the fact that we are suffering in order to give ourselves compassion. Now, actually, oftentimes we aren't aware of our own suffering, especially when that suffering comes from our own harsh self-criticism. We get so lost in the role of self-critic, so identified with the part of ourselves at the back of straight saying, you are wrong, you should have done better, that we don't even notice the incredible pain we're causing ourselves. And if we don't notice what we're doing to ourselves with our harsh self-criticism, we can't give ourselves the compassion we need. So you might be asking, you know, why do we do it? Self-criticism, we know it's painful, why do we do it? What we've actually found in research, there's a lot of reasons we're self-critical, but the number one reason is that we believe we need our self-criticism to motivate ourselves. That if we are too kind to ourselves, we will be self-indulgent and lazy. Okay? So the question is it true? Is it true? Actually, the research shows just the opposite. Self-criticism undermines our motivation, and here's why. When we criticize ourselves, we are tapping into our body's threat defense system, the reptilian brain. Okay, this system evolves so that if there was a threat to our physical person, we would release adrenaline and cortisol and prepare for the fight or flight response. Though the system evolved for threats to our actual bodily self, but in modern times, typically the threat is not to our actual selves, but to our self-concept. So when we think a thought about ourselves that we don't like, that some imperfection, we feel threatened. And so we attack the problem, meaning we attack ourselves. And with self-criticism, it's a double whammy because we are both the attacker and the attacked. So self-criticism releases a lot of cortisol. If you are a constant self-critic, you will have constantly high levels of stress, and eventually the body, to protect itself, will shut itself down and become depressed in order to deal with all the stress. And as we know, depression is not exactly the best motivational mind state, all right? Luckily, we aren't just reptiles. We're also mammals. Okay? There's another way we can feel safe, and that is by tapping into the mammalian caregiving system. What's unique about mammals is they are born very immature, which means a system had to be evolved in which the infant would want to stay close next to the mother and stay safe, which means our bodies are programmed to respond to warmth, gentle touch, and soft vocalizations. So when we give ourselves compassion, the research shows we actually reduce our cortisol levels and release oxytocin and opiates, which are the feel-good hormones. And when we feel safe and comforted, we are in the optimal mind state to do our best. And it's actually very easy to see when we think about how to best motivate our children. So let's say there is a father whose son comes home from high school with a failing math grade. The father has two different ways to try to motivate his child. The first is with harsh criticism. The son comes in, shows the father the math grade, and the father says, "I'm ashamed of you. What a loser. You'll never amount to anything." Doesn't that make you cringe? And yet, isn't that often precisely the type of language we use with ourselves? And what's going to happen to that son? Will he try harder? Well, yes, he will for the short term, but eventually he's going to lose faith in himself. He's going to become depressed, and he will become afraid of failure and probably give up math because the consequences of failing again are just too dire. But what if the father takes a compassionate approach? The son shows him the failing math grade, and the father says, "Ooh, ouch, wow, you must be hurting, I'm sorry. Hey, give me a hug, I still love you, it happens to everyone. But I know you wanna get your math grades up because you wanna go to college." Here's what compassion says: "What can I do to help? How can I support you?" And the more encouraging, loving, compassionate the father is, the better place emotionally the son will be in to do his best. And luckily, research strongly supports everything I've been saying. The last few years especially have seen a sharp uptick in the number of research studies conducted on self-compassion. And the bottom line is, unequivocally, self-compassion is very strongly related to mental well-being. It's strongly related to less depression, less anxiety, less stress, less perfectionism. It's equally strongly related to positive states like happiness, like life satisfaction. It's linked to greater motivation, taking greater self-responsibility, making healthier lifestyle choices. It's also linked to having more sense of connectedness with others, better interpersonal relationships. We've also done some research comparing directly self-esteem and self-compassion. And what we find, what you can say, is that self-compassion offers the benefits of self-esteem without the pitfalls. So it's associated with strong mental health, but it's not associated with narcissism, or constant social comparison, or ego-defensive aggression. It also provides a much more stable sense of self-worth than self-esteem does, because it's there for you precisely when you fail. Just when self-esteem deserts you, self-compassion steps in and gives you a sense of being valuable, not because you've reached some standard or you've judged yourself positively, but because you are a human being worthy of love in that moment. And again, this is something I really know from my personal life. Right. The greatest challenge I have faced in my life so far was when my son Rowan was diagnosed with autism. And luckily, when he was diagnosed, I had a long practice of self-compassion under my belt. So when I first got the diagnosis, I felt incredible grief. I even felt some shame. And it was very hard to feel that, to admit that to myself, because how could I feel grief about this child who I love more than anyone else in the world? But the thing is, I was feeling that, and I knew that what I needed at that moment was to embrace how difficult it was. And the more I could embrace my own grief, the more quickly I moved through it, and then the more able I was to turn toward him and accept and love him for who he was. It also helped me over and over again in the heat of the moment. So as you may know, one issue with autistic children, especially when they're young, is they can throw very terrible tantrums. So imagine being on a plane to England. This is a true story. Rowan was 4 years old. I don't know what set him off, but he throws a doozy of a tantrum, right? Flailing, screaming. Everyone on that plane looking at us like they wish we were dead. You know, he's 4 years old, he looks normal. People are thinking, what's wrong with this kid? Why is he acting this way? And what's wrong with this mother? Why can't she control her child? Okay, lots of fear. What do I do? What do I do? Jumping out the window sadly wasn't an option. So, okay, I know, I'll take him to the bathroom. I can try to comfort him there. Maybe it'll muffle the screams. So I'm kind of taking this four-year-old flailing child to the bathroom, which was, of course, occupied, right? So imagine being in that little space outside the bathroom door with this, you know, tantruming child, and I knew in that moment the only refuge I had was self-compassion. So I put my hands over my heart, and I tried to comfort him, but I was mainly focusing on myself. This is so hard right now, darling. I'm so sorry you're going through this, but I'm here for you. And you know what? It got me through. And by allowing myself to be open-hearted toward myself, I could remain open-hearted to Rowan. People sometimes think self-compassion is self-indulgent or selfish. It's not, because the more we are able to keep our hearts open to ourselves, the more we have available to give to others. So I would like to invite you to try to be more compassionate to yourself, especially as women. You know how to do it. You know how to be a good friend. You know what to say to comfort someone when they're in need. You just have to remember to be a good friend to yourself. It's easier than you think, and it really could change your life. And that's why I think self-compassion is an idea worth spreading.
And welcome back to Moody with Dr. Sage. You were listening to Kristen Neff talk about the difference between self-esteem and self-compassion. And so today we're going to talk a little bit more. I'm just going to kind of highlight some of the important things she talked about in case you tuned in a little bit late, or just to go through a little more thoroughly. And then I'm going to give you some ideas about how to love yourself more, and not in that sort of hokey way, but what it actually looks like. Things you can do that actually demonstrate self-love. And also an exercise around self-compassion that I truly use myself, and that I believe is very powerful. So what's really interesting to talk about is this relationship between, or how we tend to think about, self-compassion versus self-esteem. So self-esteem, as Kristen is saying, is it's a global evaluation of your self-worth. This is where you're saying, am I good or am I bad? And we used to think, okay, well, if you have really good self-esteem, then, you know, this is a pretty good marker of how you're conducting your life. But what we've begun to understand in the psychological community more and more is that just having self-esteem based on good or bad is not helpful, because it becomes very conditional. And so this is what I see all of the time. When I'm performing, when I'm delivering, when I look good, when I'm in shape, I have higher self-esteem. I have more value as a human. But what about when I'm not? What does that say about me when I'm not? When I'm feeling gross and ugly or old or unsuccessful or tired or unmotivated? does that mean that I'm not, you know, I don't have good esteem, that I'm not worthy? And so it becomes very conditional. And it's very problematic if you're just seeing yourself based on high or low self-esteem, because the whole idea is to have higher self-esteem. You have to think about yourself as above average, as better than others, or sort of hitting your game in a way that's above the mark. And so that's just not possible to do all the time. I mean, I don't know anybody who's getting up every day and nailing every single thing on their list and behaving in a way they feel great about every single day. It doesn't work that way. And so, not that you shouldn't have goals and try to accomplish things and hold yourself accountable. This isn't a everyone gets a trophy, so we're all special thing, which I know we talk a lot about. Yes, hard work is valuable. Yes, dedication and commitment matter. So this is not, none of this is saying that those things don't matter. But this idea that we have to put other people down to feel better about ourselves so we can be above average because they're just average isn't serving us. It isn't serving us individually. It isn't serving our community. And I don't believe it's serving our world. And so I sort of stumbled upon, you know, this idea. I mean, it sounds so obvious, self-compassion. When I read Kristen's book, I think it was a couple years ago, or I guess I did on Audible. I'm a huge Audible fan, or a book on audio tape, because you can be walking and exercising and in your car and learning and listening. So, you know, I bring this up a lot on the show, podcast, Audible, whatever, books on tape. But I heard her book and I thought, wow, it was kind of, it's a lot of talk about self-compassion. But what's so good about it is she talked about it so much that by the end of it, I was like, okay, I really get it. This is why it really matters. So what is self-compassion? What does it look like? What are the components? So in terms of three main components, the first one is really self-kindness. It's the idea of having patience and kindness and gentleness. This whole concept is about how we relate to ourselves, how we embrace ourselves, and really how we talk to ourselves. So ask yourself this question. How often do you say things to yourself that you would never say to someone that you love, or at least I hope that you wouldn't? Do you say things like, oh, God, you're so stupid. I can't believe you did that. Or you look ugly in that outfit, or you don't look good. We say these things to ourselves, most people, relentlessly. And so if you're hearing that message relentlessly, it's pretty hard to have self-compassion. So I think the first step is just noticing when you do it and trying to reverse it, trying to focus on what's good and what's working and what you feel good about, instead of being hypercritical and focusing on what's wrong. The second one is this idea of we all have a common humanity, that at the end of the day, we're all human beings and we all suffer. We all fail. We all strive to achieve in some way. We're all just trying to survive. And so reminding yourself that, you know, you're human. And instead of isolating or shaming yourself or choosing things to punish yourself through addictions or hurtful behaviors or words, recognizing that you're just human. You're not always going to get it right. In fact, a lot of the time, you're not going to get it right, and that's okay. The third component is really mindfulness, and I know this has become such a buzzword in the last many years, but it really is important. It's about being present with what is happening in the present moment, and if you can accept that, what's happening, you can accept that you're suffering in that moment, and you can then give yourself compassion. Whether we're saying to ourselves, you know what, you should have known better, or we're just critiquing ourselves, we have to start to be aware and be mindful of what we're doing, because oftentimes we're so conditioned to do that, we don't even know how not to do it, and we don't even know how to be aware of when we're doing it. So trying to be mindful, and there are a million zillion different mindfulness practices, from guided imagery, which I love, to meditation, to mindfulness breathing. Check anything out that you think you might be open to. It sounds kind of like, you know, woo-woo for some people, but it truly does help reduce anxiety and depression, center and ground you, and help you become aware of your thoughts and hopefully your behaviors. So one of the things that that the research has shown is that the reason why we're so self-critical is that we actually believe that if we're not, we won't be motivated, and that we're being self-indulgent or being lazy. And so if we just sort of hate on ourselves inside, that's going to motivate us to go and do what we need to do. And the research is actually showing that that is not so true. So when we're constantly criticizing ourselves, we're tapping into our fight or flight response, which is, as most people know, part of our reptilian brain that evolved to help us deal with, is a tiger going to eat me? What do I need to do right now? But the problem is the tiger going to eat me gets triggered sometimes. Most of the time, there's no tiger. We are at work or with our kids or our partners. And this way we deal with things, especially if we're being super critical or into our minds of ourselves and focusing on what's wrong, we're triggering a lot of cortisol to be released. And we are actually creating an unwellness in our bodies that our bodies have to then deal with in some fashion, whether that's creating depression or anxiety or finding ways to deal with this constant attack. And so it really is part of your well-being to begin to become aware of your self-critical nature and realizing that it's not about our self-preservation as much as it used to be. It's really now affecting our self-concept and how we see ourselves. And so if you're having anxiety and you're constantly worrying about everything and everyone and comparing yourself, or you're just turning everything inward and shutting it down and isolating and feeling sad and depressed and overwhelmed, certainly other things contribute to that as well, not just self-criticism. But that is going to tap into a deeper state of you being unable to care for yourself and unable to recognize what your body and your mind need. And one of the ways we know this is that we think about, I talk a lot about adult attachment. Obviously, if we don't attach to primary caregivers, you think about breastfeeding or nursing, historically speaking, although now we have other options, infants didn't survive. If the mother didn't survive, the infant didn't often survive unless there was a community in some way to help. And so we're wired to connect to warmth, to touch, to soft vocalizations. We know that infants respond to those things. And so we want to do the same things for ourselves when we're being self-compassionate. We want to be releasing all those feel-good hormones, oxytocin and opiates, all those things that naturally bring out that warmth and comfort inside us. And as we get older, we're often looking for other people to give that to us. But many times in our lives, either they're not capable of it, or we're not with somebody, or the person that we trusted to do that is no longer motivated to do that. And so we have to find ways to give that to ourselves. And I think that it's easy to feel comforted and safe with ourselves when we're putting ourselves in a mindset of we're worthy of being comforted and loved. And instead, if we are engaging in, you know, shaming and criticizing and comparing ourselves, or frankly, if we're doing this to our kids or our partners, we're not creating a sense of well-being in them either. One of the things I think is really important is this culture of always comparing ourselves. And so there's this thing where many people do in relationships where, you know, when you do something that's great, all they do is tell you what you did wrong or what you could do better or what you could learn from. And that's all, you know, there's a place for all of that. But sometimes you just need to listen. You just need to listen and validate your kids, your partner, yourself. Just acknowledging that not everything has to be about what you could do better next time. Sometimes we just need to listen and wrap our arms around our kids and say, you know what? I know you tried, and I know it's hard. You're going to fail. Life is hard, and it doesn't change how much I love you or care about you. This culture of comparison in Orange County is killing us, and I literally mean that. It's killing us through eating disorders and addictions and plastic surgery and this constant focus on everything that's not good. it is truly hurting us and creating so much negativity and wound in our culture. And I think we're seeing it everywhere right now. And so if you can find some compassion for yourself, you might be able to find more compassion for other people because you both deserve it. That's really the truth. The research really does support that self-compassion is strongly related to reducing stress, feeling less anxiety and depression, and experiencing less perfectionism. It's related to happiness and healthier choices and better personal relationships. The research supports it's related to stronger mental health because the more stable your sense of worth is, the more sense of feeling valuable and worthy, the more you're able to go out in the world and share that with other people. So it's not about being self-indulgent or selfish. It's just about keeping our hearts and minds open and talking to ourselves the way we would talk to someone we love. Now, someone we love is often something that comes up in terms of ourselves. I had this conversation a lot in my job about what does it mean to love yourself? And I think this is sort of something that's, you know, we used to love yourself more. I mean, okay, so how do you do that? And I think the only way, and I think I say this a lot, the only way that I'm still on the journey to learning to love myself is to know that it's my actions and how I engage in the world as much as how I think about myself that demonstrates worthiness and love for myself. And so one of the biggest ways I think we show or learn to love ourselves is we set boundaries. And this is such a therapy word, but it's really true. We say, this is what I will and will not accept from you. And you may not like it. It may not feel good. I'm not trying to hurt you, but you know, this doesn't work for me. Or I'm not going to let you continue to treat me this way. I see this a lot in girl culture, in terms of setting boundaries. I think girls are conditioned, and this is just generally speaking, this is not true for all, but we are generally conditioned and socialized to be more mindful of other people's feelings. And so it makes it really hard for us to set boundaries with other females, let alone with men. That's a whole different conversation, and one that's worthy of having another day. But in terms of just, you're not hurting someone's feelings when you're saying, hey, well, maybe you're hurting your feelings, but it's important to say, hey, you know what? Like, that doesn't work for me. You cannot treat me that way. You can't DM me that way. You can't talk to me that way. You can't use your body in that way with me. We don't know how to do that. And so we often feel like we're being bad, or we know that's going to hurt their feelings. We're so much more focused on, well, if I do that, I'm going to hurt their feelings. Yeah, so what? At some point, you're not responsible for their feelings. If you're doing it with compassion and strength and respect, that's very different than attacking, but you get to speak your mind, and it's okay. That's one huge way you are intentional in how you engage with other people. And what you will say yes to and what you will say no to really matters. And so that's a huge one. I think learning to own your story, and this is a lifelong journey, I think, for most of us, in all of its glory and all of your pain. Learning to accept that this is your story. This is where you came from. These are the experiences that you've had. And owning what's true for you and having compassion about where you came from and what you've been through. And I'm not talking about staying stuck in your childhood, but there is a moment where we have to acknowledge, hey, this is the reality. This is how I grew up. This is how I saw myself. And, or this is the bar. This is how things were set for me. And it's really hard for me to do something different. It feels really uncomfortable. That's okay. You can have compassion for yourself and say, you know what? Despite these circumstances, you're still getting out of bed every day. You're still loving your children or your partner or your family or your job. You know, reminding yourself that you don't have a perfect story. And if you did, I'd be highly suspicious of you. It doesn't exist. So really acknowledging that we are not what has happened to us, that doesn't define us, but that we can still create lives of value And it begins with having compassion for ourselves and from where we came from. It's important to choose what's right for you. And these are things like, do I need to go to the doctor more? Do I need to exercise more? Should I be looking at what I'm putting in my body from a food perspective? Should I look at my sleep? How would I tell someone I love if I was sort of my specialty was basic self-care in terms of health and well-being? How would I tell somebody else to engage? Would I say, yeah, I think it's great. You should party every night and you should, you know, eat a bunch of crap food and not take care of yourself. And yeah, you'll probably feel pretty good tomorrow. No, we all know that. So take a look at your life and see, okay, where do I need to just love on myself more? Where do I need to say, enough, this isn't working for me? Ask yourself if your love for yourself is conditional. Is this the place where you say, well, when I'm killing it at work or at school, I'm awesome, I'm great, or at the gym. But when I stopped going to the gym, when I got a grade that I didn't feel good about, which frankly is B's for a lot of this culture, which blows my mind. That's another one too. A B is not failing, people, and you know who you are. This idea of setting this value, and yes, you can feel great about working hard at something and accomplishing it, but your whole worth and sense of self is not determined by everything that you do and when you're winning it. It's also important to make time for play. This is a big one, especially as we become adults. You know, we always say that play is a child's work, and that's why we do play therapy oftentimes with kids, right? And so we're engaging in their natural way of communicating. But we grow up and become adults, and play looks like maybe it's going to Vegas and getting smashed and going to a party with your girls or guys. And okay, that's a form of play. But I'm talking more about finding ways to laugh in your day, finding ways to do things that you did as a kid just because you enjoyed them. Maybe it's going back to taking a dance class or playing on a team sport as an adult, you know, adult softball or something. I don't know. Or riding horses or painting or doing something that you do because there's no reward. You just do it because it makes you feel good. So things like traveling and massages and manicures or pedicures, time with friends and loved ones, those are all super important. Another one I think is huge is learning how to make repairs, learning how to own your part in things and say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I hurt you. I'm sorry I didn't handle that well. Can you forgive me? Can we start over? I say this a lot, but there's nothing more powerful than owning your part. Because if you don't own your part, and you hurt someone or you're insensitive or critical, then you just feel bad about yourself. And all that does is repeat this whole cycle about learning how to not be compassionate. So a compassionate person says, wow, I didn't handle that well. I apologize for it. I'm not perfect. Everyone makes mistakes. I can try harder next time to be more mindful, things like that. So making repairs is extremely powerful. And in those tough situations, just finding ways to love on yourself in the midst of something bad happening and saying, I will get through this. It's okay. It's not perfect, but you know, I just need to get through it and I'll survive this and I'm okay. This doesn't make me a bad person or not a strong person. And so the final little bit of the show is just this little exercise that Kristen Neff talks about on selfcompassion.org. And I love this one. It's really powerful. I think I blogged about this, I don't know, a year or so ago. But it's this idea that when something difficult is happening, that what you do is you lovingly talk to yourself, much the way like this, you would talk to your little one or someone that you love in a gentle way. And this is kind of what it looks like. So you're using a soothing voice. And as I'm talking now, I want you to just think of a situation in your life that's difficult, something that's causing you stress. Just bring it to your mind and see if you can actually feel the stress and discomfort in your body. So just bring up the image, bring up the idea of something you're struggling with. And this is what you do. You say to yourself, this is a moment of suffering. Suffering is a part of life. I'm not alone. I'm not the only one who struggles. And so just for now, just for today, I'm going to put my hands over my heart and just maybe both hands, clasp them together, touch your body on your chest where your heart is and say, may I be kind to myself. May I give myself the compassion that I need. May I learn to accept myself as I am. May I forgive myself. May I be strong, or may I be patient. And you can do this anytime. It's really an act of self-love to be self-compassionate. That's another huge component that you can't really have one without the other. So once again, you're just going to say, this is a moment of suffering. Suffering is a part of life. We all struggle. And may I be kind to myself. And then give yourself the words you need to be forgiving, patient, accepting, and kind with yourself. And on that note, that brings us to the end of Moody with Dr. Sage. You've been listening to a topic about self-compassion and self-love. You can check out Kristen Neff's book. You can Google. There's a million topics on self-compassion and self-love. But on selfcompassion.org, with this is Kristen Neff's website, there's a whole section on exercises you can do, from journaling to actual exercises where you are talking to yourself and learning how to integrate self-compassion. There are imagery exercises, whether it's through a meditation or an audible guided imagery. Check those out. They're really amazing. And you have to do them, you know, more than once. It's a practice. Self-compassion is not something you think of once and let go. It's just like going to the gym. It's something or exercising or learning something new. It's a consistent practice, just like yoga. And that's a huge part of it. It's just embracing that it's a journey. My favorite quote to end the show today is this: be kind, for everyone is fighting a battle you know nothing about. And guess what? That includes you. Thanks so much, and have a beautiful day.
Is it getting better? Or do you feel the same? Will it make it easier on you now? You got someone to blame. You say, one love, one life, when it's one need in the night. One love, we get to share it. Leaves you, baby, if you don't care for it. Did I disappoint you? Or leave a bad taste in your mouth? One.